Welcome to the Foxworthy Podcast. I'm Brian Fox, your host. I'm here with my co-host, Taylor Gaines. This is our first podcast of 2016.
New year, new us.
We are back. We haven't had a podcast in, what, a month now, maybe?
Well, we did one on New Year's Eve, so...
That's true. Like, we did do one on New Year's Eve. So 2 weeks. But this is our first one of the new year. We took a semi-long hiatus, but we're back. We're going to be talking about Making a Murderer today, but first I thought we'd cover, you know, we had a lot of time off with the winter break and the holidays. So, Taylor, what's going on with your cultural consumption? What did you watch and enjoy over the break?
So you want to do like a top three things we
consumed over break here? Things that you enjoyed while you had some free time?
It's funny. There was, like, no TV shows that debuted or were really running over break.
Well, yeah.
Obviously, there was one that we'll talk about in a minute that Netflix put out. But for me, I actually watched a bunch of movies, which was weird. Because I looked back through my list of movies I watched in 2015, and there were probably a single-digit number of movies on it for the whole year. But I watched a few. So I'd say my first thing I'd mention, the number three thing for me, I guess, since I'm going to rank them, was seeing Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight in the Roadshow format in Tampa where I saw it. So it was like a night at the theater, you know. You go in, they give you your program, you sit down, you hear like a really lewd speech that I'm not going to spoil for people who haven't seen the movie, and then it goes straight into intermission and everybody walks out of the theater like, what the hell? I'm trying to be really vague, obviously.
Right.
But yeah, it was a really cool movie experience. It helps break up a 3-hour movie nicely to have an intermission in the middle of it. Watching it on film was pretty cool. The only thing I'll say was just like, you know, not my favorite Tarantino movie, but it was really cool. And it's still,
like, the experience was
still
cool.
Makes, it's sort of like when people would talk about Mad Men, and they'd be like, a bad Mad Men episode is still a great episode of TV.
Right.
Or sort of like that with Tarantino, where you're like, not his best, but still really good movie.
Yeah.
My second favorite thing was probably what I did yesterday, where I went to Redbox and I watched Ex Machina, which I had not seen, but everybody, by all accounts, had said it was a good sci-fi movie, which I was just blown away by it. Again, not going to spoil it, just because that's a movie I feel like you really have to see, just to, like, appreciate the twists and the turns and the way that it develops.
That's an excellent movie. I saw it in the theater, and then I watched it again. I think I Redboxed it also, like, when it finally came out. That's a really good movie, and we should mention that the Oscar nominations came out last week, and it actually snuck in. I think it had 2 nominations, visual effects and original screenplay. That's a really good sci-fi movie, and if you love Oscar Isaac and Donald Gleason, both of whom were in Star Wars, The Force Awakens, they're both in it, and it's mostly them, and then this other actress, Alicia Vikander, who is also nominated for a totally different movie for the Oscars, The Danish Girl.
Amazing.
But she's excellent in Ex Machina.
Beautiful and just great in Ex Machina.
Yeah.
I want her to win for Danish Girl now just because of Ex Machina.
Just because of her, yeah.
But you just mentioned my number one thing. I guess this just makes me a boring, normal American person.
This is one of the things I was going to mention too.
Like,
so
Star Wars.
Yeah, let's get this out of the way.
Yeah, seeing Star Wars on opening night and then another time or two was like just awesome. I was so glad we got our own Star Wars movie. It was just such a fun experience. Like,
so much fun.
Just having something with all that mythology that you can go on the internet and just kind of debate and try to figure out what's next. And like, it's just something we don't really get a lot of anymore, especially in TV where the world's so segmented that there's not like really a show that everybody's just like gathering around every Sunday night to watch. And Star Wars was sort of like that in a really big and
the big consensus,
fun way.
Cultural consensus thing of the holidays, basically.
So yeah, I mean, 2 of my top 3 things had Oscar Isaac and Donald Gleason in them. What's your top 3 here? What did you do the last month?
I mean, I finally caught up with Fargo Season 2. I think I mentioned during the top 10, that list that we did, that if I had actually finished it, it would have been on there. And that's probably true now that I finished. It's a near perfect season of television. Really fun to watch, like visually striking, incredible ensemble cast. I'm super pumped for them to come back with another season in 2017. That was a great show. Really enjoyed watching it. I think I watched like the first few, and then the next day I just powered through the rest of it. Fargo Season 2. And if you haven't seen the first season, it's still watchable because it's like an anthology series, so it doesn't really connect that much to the first season. There's a couple characters that are like younger versions of themselves.
If you're going to watch it, I would watch the first season first.
Do watch both seasons. They're both good. And then I watched this movie that I had heard about for a while. It's a movie called Mississippi Grind, starring Ben Mendelsohn and Ryan Reynolds. It's on Amazon Prime. Prime, free to watch if you haven't. If you haven't seen it, it's definitely worth watching. If you have access to Prime, I mean, I think it's also on Redbox and stuff like that if you want to see it for cheap. But it's a really good, quiet movie. Nothing really happens in it, but there are two really good performances and just a really interesting movie, really entertaining, and from what I remember, pretty short, like an hour and 40 minutes, hour and a half maybe. So Mississippi Grind, and then yeah, Star Wars was terrific, had a great time at it. So yeah, I mean, I've been catching up on different things, just trying to watch stuff on Netflix and Amazon Prime, trying to catch up on seeing Oscar stuff. I saw Joy.
Oscar Isaac stuff.
Which was okay. Oscar Isaac stuff. I saw Joy, which was okay. I did see Hateful Eight. I didn't get to see it in the Roadshow version, because here where I live.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so I guess since you just kind of did this, like, Ex Machina's in Redbox if people want to watch it. I don't know. I'm sure you can rent it.
It's also on Amazon Prime if you have Amazon Prime. Ex Machina is free to watch there.
Hateful Eight's still out. Star Wars is still out. Not the Roadshow Hateful Eight. I think we should do one more thing before we talk about Making a Murderer. The Oscar nominations came out, and I know we don't talk a whole lot about movies on here, but let's just do, like, a quick, like, thing that made you the happiest and thing that upset you the most about the Oscar nominations.
Something that made me the happiest. I mean, I really loved Mad Max, and I'm excited that it's gotten so much acclaim, and it's a populist hit that seemed to have made money and also be like a critical darling and kind of an awards, major award season contender. That's pretty cool. I am glad that Star Wars, even though it didn't sneak into the list of Best Picture nominees, that it got 5 nominations. I think score, visual effects, sound mixing, sound editing, something else. Something that kind of bums me out. We were just talking about this before we started recording. I'm sort of over an Inuritu's thing of just being like really high on himself and thinking that everything he makes turns to gold. I haven't seen The Revenant, but you have. I'm looking forward to seeing it because I hear it's good and that it's beautiful to look at least, and it's something you should see in a theater for that reason. But I'm just kind of bummed that we might be looking at another Best Picture win for Inuritu, which is just going to fuel the fire and just make, every year he's going to make a movie that's just like super artsy and pretentious just because he thinks that that's like what people want, but I don't know. That's kind of a bummer. And then, you know, the diversity thing is like, there's nothing I can really say about it. I mean, it's frustrating, especially since, and I've heard this really, like, kind of annoying argument that there weren't any, you know, good black performances this year. Like, that's why there's only white actors nominated. But, like, I've heard excellent things about Creed. I heard that Idris Elba was excellent in Beasts of No Nation. I mean, there's plenty of others. I'm Straight Outta Compton, heard that that was a good movie. Like, there are some nominations for it, but not in the acting categories, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's frustrating. I'm going to try to see at least all the Best Picture nominees, just because that's something I like to do every year. I think I've only seen about half of them. So, I don't know. What did you have in terms of Oscar frustrations or elations?
Yeah, I mean, we won't get too into the diversity thing just because it's the Academy and it's not like it's a surprise at
this
point.
It's old white men that are on the voting body, and so they like, you know.
I mean, yeah, it's just the way they are. I mean, maybe they'll change, who knows. But I think the thing that probably frustrated me the most, just because I wasn't, like, shocked when that happened, it was just like, oh yeah, of course. You mentioned I saw The Revenant. I think the thing that frustrated me the most was when the New York Times notification popped up on my phone and said, Revenant leads Oscar noms with 12, and I was like, are you serious? Like, I think it definitely deserves, like, a cinematography and, you know, probably directing, and just, like, a lot of the visual and effects-related things were really brilliant and really well done. I just, like, I won't get too into it, which is gonna make me sound like just a bitter person, because I don't want to spoil it, but basically I just didn't really enjoy it that much, and DiCaprio...
Campaigning hard, right?
I'm of two camps on this, sort of, because I don't think he deserves it for this movie, but I also think he sort of should have won an Oscar several times already. So it's sort of like a lifetime achievement thing at this point. Yeah. It's like, he'll win for this, but it's really for
everything he's done in the past, like, 15 years.
So it's sort of a halfway frustration, disappointment thing. Mostly I was just... I've learned to not be frustrated with the Academy Awards, just because it's what it is. So mostly I was just really excited to see, you know, Mad Max with a bunch of nominations, including Best Picture. Inside Out getting a screenplay nomination was awesome, because it made me think that it must have been close to getting a Best Picture nomination if it had an original screenplay one. So stuff like that is sort of what I look for, is just stuff that makes me happy about the nominations, like things that were actually amazing being represented, instead of, like, things that suck up to Hollywood, like The Artist winning Best Picture 5 years ago or whatever that was.
Right, exactly. exactly.
But, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I'll watch it. It'll be entertaining.
It'll be an interesting show. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how these movies... It's always interesting to see, once they win, you know, how they kind of stay in the public consciousness or don't. You know, some movies just completely fade, and people are like, oh, yeah, that won an Oscar. And some movies are like, everyone's like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, Oscar winner, such and such. I think last year people were very divided. I know a lot of people really actually thought that Birdman deserved to win, which was the other Iñárritu movie from last year, Alejandro Iñárritu, the director of The Revenant. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it's an interesting list. Not too many surprises, but I'm going to watch all these movies. I'm actually really looking forward to watching The Martian, which I still haven't seen.
Yeah,
which
it's is a now... shame that the Academy Awards don't have, like, best dramatic movie and best comedic movie, right, so that The Martian could rack up another best comedy win.
Have you seen it yet?
No.
I hear it's just a really, like, fun, entertaining movie that's got a great ensemble cast.
Is it a comedy? The Golden Globes gave it the best comedy.
I've heard that it's ridiculous to classify it as a comedy, but like the Matt Damon performance is just like pitch perfect. Like his tone and his delivery of like the humor is just like pitch perfect and tailored to what he's best at. So that's why I think that they were just like, well, it's a comedy because there's like Matt Damon's being funny in it, but it's not really a comedy.
And before we transition to TV real quick, since we sort of just name dropped the Golden Globes, like, so Mozart in the Jungle won, what, best TV show?
And best actor?
For, like, a comedy or musical or something?
Yeah, I guess.
Let me just say, we're probably not going to be talking about Mozart in the Jungle on this podcast.
Probably
at
not.
At least for a while. I just, like, I don't know. I've watched trailers of it and read things about it, and I'm just like, how the hell...
Like, what's interesting is I've heard a lot of people say that it's a perfectly fine, enjoyable show, and it's, I think, the only maybe thing to its benefit is that I'm pretty sure it's a half hour, not an hour.
Right.
Like, it's not a heavy drama. It's a half hour comedy. It sounds very light and breezy, but it doesn't seem like something that I'm like necessarily clamoring for. But you know, this is just how these things shake out. The Globes like to reward new shows. They did reward Mr. Robot, which we've both raved about on this podcast before. But I know that they had a Television Critics Association just had a panel about Mr. Robot season 2. That's coming pretty soon, next, you know, 5 months, 6 months or so. So
anyway, let's get to
something really, really interesting. So over the holidays, I don't know the exact day that this dropped, but you know, Netflix is infamous for putting out a show and they'll drop all the episodes of a season on one day. So they have a documentary series made by two filmmakers, but essentially they filmed this footage for this about this case in Wisconsin over 10 years. The show is entitled Making a Murderer, 10 episode documentary series. So essentially the first episode explains that this young man, Stephen Avery, is sent to prison for a rape, and after spending 18 years in prison, he's exonerated because DNA evidence proves that he didn't do it. And then basically the filmmakers lay out this whole scenario where it seems as though law enforcement, they were convinced that he did it or wanted to put someone away for this rape. Seems like they kind of framed him and they just wanted a culprit to put in jail. So he goes to jail for 18 years, and basically the first episode is him going to jail and getting out after 18 years, and the episode ends with you hear a phone call, yes, we found a body, do we have Stephen Avery in custody? And there's a whole new case and a new murder that he's now a suspect for.
I was gonna say, just from this point forward, if people haven't watched the show yet and they want to, stop listening, I guess. Because I think we're going to get into some of the details of what happens the last 9 episodes.
A lot of this stuff has been highly publicized before this documentary was even released by Netflix. But it is true. It is a true crime story. Supposedly, you know, they filmed all this stuff over 10 years. So there may be some stuff you're familiar with if you haven't watched it. But yeah, we are going to get into spoilers if you don't want to know the details. I mean, it's out there, you know. Even if you don't watch the show, there's plenty of stuff out there in the news. You know, this guy has been in and out of the news for 30 years, basically. So,
and if you don't want to spend 11 hours watching a true crime show, then you can just keep listening.
We're just going to talk to Stephen Avery and
the criminal justice system.
So what do you want to say? Something to start us off, just like how this show is made, the way that it's, the way the story is told, what they present to you.
Well, let me say first,
what the goal of the filmmakers is.
Let me say first, if people, either if they have or haven't watched it, here's what the number one lesson. And obviously this can be hard to do if you're in the moment of being arrested or whatnot. But I think you should call a lawyer and say nothing to the police until your lawyer gets there in like almost any situation. Because a lot of the problems that Brendan Dassey and Stephen Avery run into over the course of this 10-year escapade, I guess, is have to do with things that were said when a lawyer wasn't around.
Yes.
Or, to say the very least of it. And, like, it just seems like a thing you should do. But I think here's what I think the filmmakers want people to take away from this. I think they want people to watch this and think, not necessarily Stephen Avery is innocent and he was framed. I think they want people to watch this and come away and say, our criminal justice system seems designed in a way that you are guilty until proven innocent in a lot of cases, and it's not supposed to be that way.
Right.
There needs to be some kind of critical re-examination of the way that things work and the way that we approach these things, just because it's very clear throughout the entire show that they all think he's guilty right off the bat.
Right.
And the defense is the team that has to do all the work to try to prove him innocent, basically. There's even a line, which is, this is just baffling to me, in the closing arguments of the Stephen Avery trial, district attorney basically says, reasonable doubt is for innocent people. He's like, Stephen Avery does not deserve reasonable doubt. And you're like, that is not what that means or how that works. And it doesn't make any sense. It's just so, there are a lot of things that feel wrong and corrupt about district attorney's office and the police department in this series, but like, it was more things like that where they were trying to just disregard the law that stuck out to me. I don't know, what was your right, biggest takeaway from this?
So just to summarize kind of what the show is actually showing, it's really interesting the way that they, first few episodes, they kind of show you the different members of his family. You know, you meet his mother, you meet his father, and I guess they run an auto salvage. They have, you know, this huge property where they have all these cars that are going to be salvaged, and they paint this impression, this picture that their family is definitely not wealthy. And I mean, this may sound offensive, but they're not like the brightest people in the world. They're poor, and they're not necessarily that well educated. After he's exonerated for spending 18 years in prison for the rape that he did not commit, he is in the middle of a lawsuit, trying to, you know, get compensation for having been wrongfully convicted. And there is an entirely new case, a murder. I guess he was working with Stephen Avery was working with this woman, Teresa Hallback, who wanted to take pictures for Auto Trader magazine, and they had a transaction before, and I guess they kind of knew each other just through business. The Avery family owns Avery's Auto Salvage. And so, basically, just a few weeks after this lawsuit, Teresa Hallback goes missing, and they basically immediately arrest Stephen Avery. And so the show covers his murder trial, and it covers basically his defense, like his defense team is trying to show evidence that the evidence against Stephen Avery was planted. And it's actually really compelling because they kind of make a strong case, but then nobody really listens. They're like, basically the prosecution is like, this is ludicrous, like, no one would ever do this. And there's all these really complicated things, you know. Eventually, the show starts to cover his nephew, Brendan Dassey, who also lived on the same property, you know, this kind of Avery compound where Avery's auto salvage is. And this poor kid is like, what, 15 or 16 when the police first interrogate him, the investigators?
Incredibly stupid.
And he's apparently not very bright, like really not well educated. Just this poor, potentially innocent kid. And they basically, like, convince him to say things that never... Well, he eventually recants and claims that never happened.
The key moment is...
So it follows both Stephen Avery and his nephew, and basically them being on trial for this murder that they may or may not have committed. And there's some pretty compelling evidence that definitely insinuates that after the exoneration with the Manitowoc County Police Department, they basically didn't want to look bad, and they wanted Stephen Avery to go back to jail to stop the lawsuit and to prove once and for all that he really was a guilty criminal after being exonerated 18 years in prison. What you take away from it is just that the system seems fairly well set up, and, you know, everyone, like you were saying, everyone has a right to a fair trial, and we're sort of in this reverse position where instead of everyone being presumed innocent until proven guilty, it's sort of the opposite, where if you're accused and you're charged with something, you're guilty until they prove you innocent. And that's essentially what the entire show is his defense team has such an uphill battle trying to prove that he didn't do it. And they find some really fascinating bits that point towards Manitowoc County Police Department being involved when they actually shouldn't have been, because I think that it was deemed a conflict of interest and they were not supposed to have to get in the investigation of the crime. And I guess they had way more of an involvement than they were ever supposed to. So that kind of stuff is presented to you through the show and you're watching it and you're like, how did this happen? And how come nobody thinks of this as a problem?
Yeah, it's basically, I don't think we should get too much into the Stephen Avery stuff just because I think it's very unclear whether he was guilty or not guilty. I think for anyone to watch that show and just like assume that he's innocent is kind of crazy and like you're not really thinking very much, but like it definitely is some really compelling stuff and a lot of really interesting coincidences. The thing that stuck out to me about this show was how cruel this whole system was to Brendan Dassey. The 9th episode focuses mostly on sort of what he went through, and the 3rd and the 9th one basically. The 3rd one has the key moment in his life where he's being interrogated and the FBI guys? I don't remember.
Yeah, but I think so or something.
Basically, the FBI guys or the investigators, whatever they are, they have information that only people who were involved in the death of Teresa Halbach would know, which is that she was shot in the head. And they're trying to get Brendan to say this because then they'll know he was involved with the crime. And basically, there's like this 3 or 4 hour interrogation where his story keeps changing. You watch it and it's so, it clearly looks like an interrogation where you're watching it and he's just like, yes, and they're like, no, and he's like, no. And
right, they're getting him to say specific things so that they have someone to blame. And
Brendan is clearly trying to say what he thinks they want to hear. And I don't know how, this is what blew my mind more than the middle 7 episodes, is I don't know how the jury of the Brendan Dassey trial could watch that confession and not think it was forced and manipulated.
How sad was it too? This is something you cannot plan for. Like the filmmakers, I'm assuming, didn't do anything to this tape. Like this is just the interrogation tape. How depressing is it and so like heartbreaking when he's like, how long is this gonna take? And they're like, oh, you know, you're gonna be here for a few hours or whatever. He's like, I have a project due at 1 o'clock or whatever for school. He has no idea what is happening to him. He literally just thinks they're gonna ask him questions and he's gonna get to go back to school.
So basically they can't get him to say that she got shot in the head. So then the one guy says, did he shoot her in the head? And Brendan's like, yeah. He shot her in the head.
Like he's like, oh, like, that's what I wanted to say all along, but I like didn't know what
and
you were looking for.
Like you watch it and you're like, oh my god, like the level of incompetence and failure on the interrogators here is amazing. And like now his life is basically over. And then his lawyer that he has appointed is horrible. I don't know how that guy didn't get disbarred. Len Kaczynski or whatever.
Yeah, Len Kaczynski.
Like he basically is never present when Brendan's being questioned about anything. And then, like, he hires this guy to force another confession out of Brendan to help the government against Stephen Avery in the other case. It's a nightmare.
Right, so
basically, what I wanted to say is I come away from the show feeling horrible for Brendan Dassey because this kid is not intelligent. Even his lawyers argue, like, listen, this kid is dumb, basically, in court.
Yeah.
They're like, listen, he's stupid. How could you guys think that he, whatever.
Which is so sad, and he's literally just sitting there. At one point, his lawyer, the lawyer that actually is in his he has during his trial after he goes through a few other lawyers, that lawyer is like, he's like, what you see in court where he's just sort of staring off into space, like looking at his fingers and like barely responding to anything, like that's what he's like. Like he says it's not an act. That's who he is. Like there's no way that he could have committed any of these crimes. And it's how horrible was that guy, the guy that was working with his lawyer that got pulled from him, Len Kaczynski, the other guy, the investigator, Michael O'Kelly, where he like makes him draw the stuff that he supposedly said he did, but was really just like stuff that seems very much coerced from
out of him. How about the prosecutor saying innocent people don't confess to crimes they didn't commit during the trial? You're like, that is false. Like, that's just false. Like, it's, there's,
right.
we don't have to get into that, but it is. Like, go look it up. It was just brutally sad watching the Brendan, like, yeah. He's calling his mom, like, can you record WrestleMania for me? And you're like, dude, you're not getting out. Like, you're gonna miss WrestleMania. Like, that was the biggest takeaway for me, was it just seemed like, I don't think he was involved. Like, I mean, he could have been, obviously, but
he could have been involved in some way.
It seems a lot less likely than for Stephen Avery to have actually
committed it. Yeah. Committed it.
The one other thing I wanted to cover before we get out of here, since we're journalists, we're journalism majors, both of us, it was really interesting to me the way that this was portrayed by the media early on in the whole saga. It just sort of made me think, you have to think about all of the kinds of questions you can ask about something when you're doing a story about something, because at the beginning, you know, the media is basically playing catch up the whole time, because they come out and they're like, here's the way it's described by Brendan Dassey and it's horrible and blah blah blah, and then only later they're like, oh my gosh, like is it possible his confession could have been forced? And like,
right.
It's just like, there's all these questions that they should have at least been thinking about asking that they don't come up with until later. And it was just kind of an interesting lesson in critical thinking as a media person, not to mention how sensitive media people should be toward family of criminals or those accused of crimes. It was just a really, that was a really interesting part of it for me, was all that stuff.
How did you feel, like, did you think that overall it was like effective as a story? Did you feel like it was one-sided or manipulated at all? That would be maybe my only complaint overall about it as an experience, is that it very much feels like the filmmakers found this case, heard about this case, and decided that it seems very much like they have a side in it, and that they have stakes, and that they desperately want to put the documentary out there to get people to question if Manitowoc County actually planted evidence, which there's no way of really knowing at this point. You know, they show in the trial that the blood was tested, and they, you know, they couldn't prove that it was planted, that it was from a vial in an evidence room, and it's all this complicated stuff. But I think something that I found, I guess, interesting, and this is sort of an interesting thing I think to debate with these kind of true crime things, especially if it's done in like a documentary style, is like how you edit footage together and how you basically present your case. Like, you have to put, you know, this piece of footage here, and then you put, you know, this caption here that says on this date this happened, and you know, they withhold certain information, like that god-awful DA Ken Kratz, who I wanted to punch in the face the entire series, like, finally gets it in the end, because he gets caught sexting with clients and stuff, and he basically, you know, resigns, loses his job or whatever. But did you feel like it was, like, effective in, or did you feel like it was very much, like, a one-sided thing?
It was
not necessarily that they edited the footage, but the way that they, not necessarily that they took footage and manipulated footage, but just the way that they cut it together to present their case.
It was definitely distracting.
And withholding information, you know, to like have a gotcha moment three episodes later.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was definitely a distraction, just because I was trying to think critically about it most of the time, just because that's just the way that my brain works. And it's really distracting when it's clearly not presented in like a really objective way. You find yourself, or I found myself, wanting to side with the prosecution, or at least to think about things from their angle, just because the documentary was so blatantly like portraying them as villains, and
right.
like even portraying the family of Teresa Halbach as like sketchy people. There were some things that were a little off, and like it is really dumb that the police never investigated people that were close to her, since, you know, most murders
right.
happen with people that are
yeah.
close to people. But like, part of me was just like, this family, like, just had someone they love get killed, and they're being portrayed in this, like, they're just like suspicious and odd, where like, you know, obviously we'll never know the truth, but like, it just seemed like it was really distracting how, like, I guess biased it was, but it's definitely, it's such an interesting and compelling story that like, it still is, you know, I got through that 11 hours or whatever much quicker than I ever thought
right.
I would.
On that note, can we just talk about how they basically dropped this over the holidays, and this was like the thing that people were watching with their families, like over Christmas and New Year's? Like, this was like family time, get together and bit. And it's an interesting model for, I actually found it hard to binge because I found it just really unsettling and not really fun. Punishing. Like, it was definitely, yeah, kind of punishing. Like, it was riveting, but I wouldn't say that it was, like, fun, or I wouldn't necessarily use the word, like, I enjoyed it. Yeah, I thought it was fascinating, and I thought it was well done, but...
Yeah, I think if people like true crime, they would want to watch it.
For sure.
If you're just fascinated by stories that just go in directions you don't expect. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you listened to Serial, and you thought the podcast from last year that had a similar sort of premise.
Serial season one.
Did he do it?
Definitely recommendable.
But if you listened to that and came away thinking, I'm so upset that I don't know whether he killed her or not, then, like, I probably wouldn't watch it.
You have to watch it kind of knowing that, like, it is true crime, and, like, these dudes are still in jail for the rest of their life, and they've been denied early release or
parole. Well, Brendan can get out in 2048, right. I believe.
But that's still, like... He's going to be what? What did they say? Like, he's going to be 58 if he gets out at that time. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely worth watching. I don't know that I would be like, go watch it. It's so, like, good. It's good. It's riveting. It's well made. It's seamlessly edited. Maybe a little too much. Like, it's a little too put on and put together. Like, so it's, like, packaged so nicely to present, you know, what the filmmakers want you to take away from it. It's definitely riveting. And, you know, it's in, as we mentioned, like, with Serial, there's no real conclusion. Like, these guys are still in jail, so, like, it doesn't have a satisfying ending. It is what it is. Making a Murderer, Netflix. It's a very interesting thing that it has that... I feel like people did binge watch it because it's kind of sort of compulsively watchable, but I also had, like, a hard time. Like, I would watch it before bed, and then I would have a hard time, like, going to sleep because I was just thinking about all these things that were happening in it. But is there anything else we want to touch on or say about this show or about this kind of show?
I feel like we're trying to get back into the podcast groove. I am interested.
Coerced someone, into a
someone mentioned Someone mentioned to me that after the documentary came out, that Manitowoc basically came out and said, like, you know, they left a lot of stuff out of this. And I heard that too. I still haven't actually gone and looked to see what they allegedly left out, so I am interested to look at that.
And we should mention that Stephen Avery has a girlfriend named Jody, who's featured heavily in, like, one or two of the episodes, and she just came out, like, last week after the documentary was sort of picking up all this attention and all this. She basically said that she was in a relationship with him for 2 years, and it wouldn't surprise her at all, and she absolutely believes that he's guilty because he was abusive to her in the 2 years that they were together, and he basically felt like a great injustice had been done to him when he was convicted of the rape that he didn't commit, and that he's sort of getting revenge on women, and, you know, that he was basically a horrible person, and so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. I mean,
I guess
you don't see her that much in the show overall when you think about how little she's in the 10 episodes, but their relationship in the show is portrayed as very loving. He's like, oh, I'm gonna wait for you, like, while he's in prison. Like, you know, she's like, she goes to visit him, and they seems like they're getting along, and they're, the only interaction we get from them is very, you know, kind, and, you know, like, a good, they have a, seems like they have a fine, perfectly fine relationship.
I'm not sure how to think about this, but she also was in jail several times for DUIs, so, like, you know, I don't know, who knows how good her memory was at that time. But yeah, it's really, there's just so many layers to this.
So many layers. Multi-layered. I mean, definitely watch it. I guess we'll sign off. I don't know what we're going to talk about next week.
We probably went a little long today just because we've been off the schneid for a little while. But I think we mentioned previously we're going to sort of go into a new format this year. Mm. I think we're going to try to be doing 2 shorter episodes usually per week.
Right.
Where it'll be, like, one non-spoilery one where we can kind of talk about a show and, I guess, see if it'll turn people onto it or not. Mm-hmm. And then more of a spoilery one where we'll get kind of more in-depth.
Yeah. Our goal is to kind of break down things from, like, a story perspective and sort of looking at writing, you know, scripts and the story and the arcs and, like, the writing of characters and the writing of actual plot. And so we have a Twitter account now. If you go on Twitter, search at Foxworthy Pod, Foxworthy spelled the usual way, FAUXWORTHY. You can find me at FoxBJ_88. You can find Taylor at Gaines Taylor, and new column for GainesvilleScene.com. Hidden in Plain View, and I guess we will be back next week. I don't know what we're going to talk about, but we'll give you something new and fresh, hot and tasty.
Hot takes.
Thank you very much for listening. Bye.